Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
After the Rushdie affair in 1989, there was an important shift in the public life of British Muslims. Their image came under closer scrutiny, which led to new social policies and self-perceptions. This moment also served as a significant pivot in the narrative and representational patterns in British Muslim literature. Claire Chambers, senior lecturer at the University of York, examines these new paradigms in Making Sense of Contemporary British Muslim Novels, published with Palgrave in 2019. She outlines Muslim cultural production during this period through a literary analysis of the senses, especially those beyond the visual. Overall, Chambers provides a rich portrait of the non-visual senses in British Muslim fiction over the past three decades. This book also continues the work of her previous one, Britain Through Muslim Eyes, Literary Representations 1780 to 1988, also published with Palgrave. In our conversation, we discussed the Rushdie affair and its consequences, how to approach touch, smell, taste, and hearing in literature, the senses in a digital age of advanced technology, the role of Islam in contemporary literary representation, the construction of religious practice or gendered norms, radicalization, and authors such as Hanif Qureshi, Monica Ali, and Mohsin Hamid, among many others. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Claire Chambers about Making Sense of Contemporary British Muslim Novels. Welcome, Claire. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining us again, I should say. This is your second interview. Thanks for making time to talk about your new book.
Thank you, Christian. A real pleasure to speak to you again.
Yeah, so this book, Making Sense of Contemporary British Muslim Novels, is a continuation of your previous work, of the wonderful book that we spoke about, Britain Through Muslim Eyes, Literary Representations, 1780 to 1988. And this one picks up where you left off pretty much, at least in terms of the time frame. But this book, I think, also does really interesting stuff in terms of the type of kind of theoretical approaches you explore, kind of moving beyond the eyes and the visual and sight, and exploring this kind of vast sensory perception that comes through in these wonderful novels. So it's really an excellent book.
Thank you. I mean, as always, I didn't write the book I thought I was going to write. this is what happens to me. It's a whole journey. Written Through Muslim Eyes, I thought would be this history that would pack in everything from the year dot to the present. But the more you look at Muslim writing, it goes back a long way. So as you know, I ended the project, Britain Through Muslim Eyes, just before Rushdie, I cut it off. And this book was supposed to be Rushdie to the present. But in the end, I only talk about Rushdie in the introduction at some length. The chapters themselves are about the 90s to the present day. And what I became very excited about was continuing the theme of the senses that I did introduce in Britain Through Muslim Eyes. I had a lot on the gaze and the reverse orientalist gaze of the traveller from South Asia or the Arab world and from Muslim backgrounds. And they were looking at Britain and comparing often negatively to their home country, which was often they viewed it as superior. So there was a kind of reverse on orientalism going on. And I noticed a lot of tropes of looking and seeing and eyes in those texts that I looked at. So when I moved to the more recent writing, they were just highly sensual texts. So I ended up writing on the other four senses. So I open with the 1990s and two novels that are very sexy, and I did a whole lot of stuff around touch and the haptic. And then in a middle part on the 2000s, the first decade of the century, I talked about olfaction and smell in relation to Monica Ali and Nadeem Aslam. And I also talked about taste in relation to three Arab and Persian writers, Arab and Iranian writers, because I had touched on taste, as it were, in Britain Through Muslim Eyes in relation to the history of curries and South Asian food in Britain. So it was really good to expand that discussion of food into the sort of Mediterranean and the Middle East. And then finally, I looked at sound and the post-human in the technologized 2010s in the final part. So in chapter five, I talk about terror and listening in relation to Kamala Shamsi's Home Fire and Tavish Kerr's Just Another Jihadi Jane. And then finally, I have a whole chapter on Mohsin Hamid's Exit West, where I'm thinking about phones and drones and how the senses open up when technology gets involved.
Now, for those that might be wondering about the timeline, this break in 1989, you kind of hammer down that this is really a significant shift, and probably a more useful one in the British context than perhaps other markers that people might think of. Can you just I know this is kind of like one of your new unique takes, so what can you give us just like a brief summary of 1989 and like what happens for the British Muslim community kind of after this period? What are kind of the significant changes that reflect or are reflected in this literature you look at?
That's a great question. It's difficult to identify any one turning point, and I hope I'm not doing that. But 1989 is a very crucial moment in Britain, and perhaps more so than 9/11 in a British context, even though 9/11 and the year 2001 has been very significant too. But 1989 is really where a lot of things changed for Muslims in Britain. And of course, that was due to the Rushdie affair. So Rushdie published the Satanic Verses in autumn 1988, and it was controversial from the outset. Some British Muslims actually wrote to Rushdie and asked for an insertion, a preface just saying that this was a work of fiction and distancing himself from people thinking it was a factual book about the Prophet and his history. Rushdie wasn't prepared to do that. He wanted to present it as he'd written it. He didn't want to sort of hedge it around. And in India, the writer Khushwant Singh immediately saw that it could be controversial with Muslims in India, so the book was banned there. And then in Britain, where it was not banned, it was being passed around, decontextualized, and campaigns against it. And in my area where I live now, in Yorkshire, in Bradford, and also in Lancashire, Bolton, there were protests, and it all started to gather ahead of steam. Then, as you know, on Valentine's Day, February the 14th, 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini issued his fatwa, the religious opinion, saying that this book was blasphemous and offering reward for any Muslim who would kill the author or other people involved in the publication of the Satanic Verses. So Rushdie went into hiding for nearly a decade. Awfully, several people, including the Japanese translator, were killed in violence due to this controversy. So in terms of what this means and why this is a big shift for how Muslims are viewed in Britain, it's the way that they were presented in the mainstream media was very, in a very simplistic and binary ways. They were othered right from the outset. So in the protests, there are famous newspaper reports seeing them as alien, that they came down from the north of England. They had long beards, they were mostly men, and they were violent and extreme. This is the way they are more and more being portrayed in the tabloid press at this time. It's notable, actually, that the word Islamophobia really gained currency in the 1990s, not post-9/11. So in the British context, there was the Renamed Trust published their report on Islamophobia in 1997, I think. So well before 9/11, Muslims in Britain were being othered, were on the receiving end of hatred. And so 9/11 certainly made that more concrete, and legislation was brought in, and the securitisation that we see in this century, which has been terrible and shouldn't be overlooked. But I think it is a continuum, and that it goes back to 89, which was also significant in other ways, like the, you know, of course, we all know about the collapse of communism that year. Also the invention of the World Wide Web, and Tim Berners-Lee putting his almost finishing touches to that project of the internet, which is something very important for this book. So 1989 is important in lots of different ways. Obviously for me, Rushdie is at the heart of that.
Now, in terms of kind of British Muslim cultural production, there's really steady growth after this period. Whereas in your first book, the materials you had available were much more limited in scope and genre and these kind of things. Can you talk about kind of, what were some of the broader shifts you noticed in terms of British Muslim literature, in terms of genre, in terms of themes? And then why exactly did you pick the books you did to focus on? Because you could have, there was numerous books you could have picked to look at.
That's a great question as well. There's a lot there. So in terms of what you said at first, definitely we've really got a treasure trove of writing, spoiled for choice in the post-1989 period, whereas previously in Britain Through Muslim Eyes, I, for example, didn't find a text that I wanted to look at for the 1970s. There just wasn't anything appropriate, really. But you could not say that for the decades subsequently. I had to leave a lot out, and I'll talk to you about why I picked certain ones and left out others shortly. The shift in terms of genre and theme. I think Rushdie leaves his mark in the 90s. The writers that I've chosen, Adat Suwayf in her novel In the Eye of the Sun, and Hanif Qureshi is actually fictionalizing the Rushdie affair in the Black Album from 1995. There's quite a strong emphasis on humor, which might seem surprising in the light, the Rushdie affair being, cataclysmic and very frightening and very divisive. But humour does come into play quite a bit in both those authors, as well as sexuality. So this is why touch was my big focus in the first part. That writers are, perhaps in reaction to increasing stereotypes of the austere, sexually repressed Muslim, they're very playful, very frank. Adat Suwayf in particular is extraordinary novel, almost 1,000 pages, completely gripping, semi-autobiographical and very honest about sex, miscarriage, about sugaring of one's pubic hair, about torture, about all different things that are done to bodies, childbirth, and bad sex and good sex, really, in that novel. And, you know, so it, this is really quite counter-stereotypical. And similarly, Hanif Qureshi in The Black Album, is his novel is a novel of ideas about ideas of religious purity versus kind of hedonism of the 90s, the rave scene and dance music and drugs, ecstasy. He's juxtaposing those. It's not really a very balanced novel of ideas. Ultimately, it's pretty clear that he's on the side of secularism and sex and pleasure. But he does give a hearing and is perhaps at his best when he's trying. I mean, he's not brilliant at on the Muslim side of things, I would argue, but he's at his best when he's writing about racism and the internalization of racism that makes Shahid, the character, turn to an extremist group while he's at university. Then in the 2000s, so we're talking about post 9/11, actually, because both novels are from, in fact, all the novels I look at are from, you know, after, I think, 2004. There is this turn to sensuality, and Nadeem Aslam's Max Philosophers and Monica Ali's Brick Lane have both been looked at quite a bit through the lens of taste, and there's lots of imagery of food. So I wanted to do something different. So I looked at smell in those novels, and smell as something that is used a lot in racial discourse. You know, smell is invasive. You can't really avoid it. You've got to breathe in. So smell is quite it can be a toxic and full of hatred sense. Racists often use the language of smell to express that disgust. And it's there in both in discussions of racism in those two novels, but also more enjoyably, the smells of food, the smells of incense hang over the novels. Music is compared with smell in an almost synesthetic way. Then moving on to the taste chapter, I called that chapter Taste the Difference. It's about the sort of almost food porn in some of these novels, about saffron and rice in steaming piles, about the pleasures of eating, but also, you know, the prohibitions around food. So I wrote at some length about the halal issue. And I'm just thinking about genre. The novel was my focus. I did bring in, I mean, chick lit starts to come through, especially in the post 9/11 period. Authors like Leila Abulela and Yasmin Crowther are certainly playing with the chick lit genre. And in our current decade, this theme of listening to the other, sort of politics of listening, comes through a lot. In Home Fire, the jihadist character Parvez is working, he goes to Syria, to Raqqa, to work as a sound man, recording the sounds of a blade through a neck, for example, for ISIS. And he's actually sickened. He's sickened by what he sees there. He's quite an artistic character, and he's been very naive, very wrong-headed in joining up, and is not prepared for what he finds there. But it's all through this sense of listening that we learn a lot. He wants to record 24 hours of a normal London day when he's at home. And so he's really a frustrated artist in many ways. And if he had been listened to more in a British context, he might not have been radicalised, I think the novel is saying. Tabish Kher's Just Another Jihadi Day, and I put together with Kamala Shamsi's Home Fire. And the Kher's novel also has quite a lot on listening, about how women's laughter is looked on askance by ISIS. They have to stifle their voices in northern Syria. And finally, this theme of post-human sensory perception, which I trace in Mohsen Hammad's Exit West. I did a whole reading of the helicopter sounds over the novel, the surveillance drones as well that hang over the characters, you know, looking at the refugees and migrants and keeping tabs on them through, you know, very cutting edge technologies. I brought in the cyborg Donna Haraway and, you know, Rosie Bray-Dottie on the post-human for this chapter, and really enjoyed exploring what happens to the senses as we're, you know, constantly glued to our phones nowadays. So there's kind of new sensual experiences coming through there. I want to just briefly talk about why I picked up on these particular novels and left out others. I do talk about that in the conclusion. There was quite a few that I regretted leaving out, but in the end I wanted this one, unlike the survey that was Britain Through Muslim Eyes, I wanted this to be a real critical work where I could go in, really zoom in on these texts. So I carefully patterned it so that I had 5 women and 5 men writers. I also wanted a range of backgrounds. Unfortunately, in the end, I didn't have a Turkish writer, so my biggest regret is probably leaving out Elif Shafak's Honor, which could have been included in the taste chapter quite well, because there's stuff on racism of food, and the protagonist's love interest works as a baker. But in the end, I just had too many, and I liked keeping the 5 women and 5 men together, so that's how I worked it out.
Wow, that was an impressive run through as well. you really have mastery of all these titles. The other thing I should note for listeners who may be interested in the book is you really do the same kind of like very what seems like effortless synthesis of not only the titles that you're specifically looking at, but then how they relate to broader issues going on in society, how they relate to other texts, both literary texts, but then also theoretical texts, and it's really an impressive work. And many of these chapters probably could work very well, isolated, from the book. If somebody wanted to incorporate something about literature from, recent British Muslim authors, they could pull out the last chapter, the last 2 chapters, very easily without, losing the main crux of the book. So
thank you. That's really good to hear, actually, because that's what I'm aiming to do, but I'm never sure if it's paying off.
Yeah. So since you've kind of taken us through much of what you've done, if you don't mind, I'm going to kind of zoom into a couple works that I was specifically interested in. And one, I'm a big fan of Hanif Qureshi's, both his kind of literary work, but then also his visual productions, and kind of the relationship between those. And you look at the Black Album as your kind of text for analysis, but you also do a really good job in that chapter of kind of thinking about his larger body of work. And the other thing that might be interesting for listeners to kind of get an idea of what's going on more broadly among several of the authors is he, of course, was well known before the Rushdie affair, and then continued to be well known and well received. So can you talk a little bit about kind of what you do in your analysis of the Black Album? But then, if possible, do you think you could talk about kind of the pre-Rushdian era and the post-Rushdian era shift that happens in his work, specifically related to Islam, because that seems to be one of the things that changes his attitudes or representations of Islam and what that means for British Muslims.
Yes, absolutely. It's a great question. So pre-Rushdie affair, he was well known for My Beautiful Laundrette, the film from 1985, in which there are British Pakistani characters and first generation migrants from Pakistan living in Britain, and nationality and race are much more points of interest, and sexuality is always Qureshi's bread and butter. Religion doesn't come into it much at all. There is There's a few references to religion, but they're very for our, you know, contemporary students who were born after 9/11 nowadays, they're quite surprised how little mention is made of Islam because it becomes such a hot topic. In the film, there's just the drug dealers wearing this drug dealer has a fake beard to hide the drugs in, so he looks like a mullah or a malvi, but is in fact cover for narcotics. And there is the wronged wife, who the uncle Nasser is cheating on. This Pakistani wife tries to do black magic on, and succeeds actually on Rachel, Nasser's girlfriend. So that's kind of an accretion associated with Islam, kala jadu, you know, black magic, that's actually frowned upon in Orthodox circles, but is believed to be a spiritual practice. So there's these little mentions, but really it's a film about race and sexuality and class. Then there was The Buddha of Suburbia. Again, there's a few mentions of religion. Again, it's British Pakistani Muslim families or Indian Muslim families in Britain. The father, Jamila's father, goes on hunger strike like Gandhi to protest because he wants his daughter to have an arranged marriage. So he's always been quite a liberal character, but he has this sort of turn towards tradition and Indian nationalism in order to get his daughter in line. And he maybe brings up religion a few times. But again, it's surprising how little it comes in to that novel, which was published, I think, in 1990, just before. But it was written before, mostly written before the Rushdie affair. So then the first novel after the Rushdie affair is The Black Hand, which I talk about. And as I said before, it's about a boy turning to religious extremism while at university in London. So it's very prescient because it's thinking about Islamism and Islamic militantism in the 90s, which not many people had done. And it, as I said before, there is a certain lack of nuance in his portrayal. He's not good at thinking about moderate Muslims or really explaining the attractions to religion beyond an anti-racist stance. But what I think's especially interesting with Qureshi is that after, because he was good friends with Rushdie, Qureshi's a little younger and looks up to Rushdie. And in pretty much every essay that he's written since then, he brings up the Rushdie affair one way or another. And he is very much on Rushdie's side and can make quite sweeping comments about political Islam, sometimes in ways that are not so well informed, though he is seen as something as a spokesperson on these matters. And he brought out The Word and the Bomb, a whole collection of his essays on Islam this century. So it's had a profound impact on him, as it would do if you're friends with somebody and his going into hiding happened. It also comes back in his fiction. So he didn't just limit it to the Black Album, but he made a film and a short story that became a film, My Son the Fanatic, a few years later in 1997, around that sort of time, which is again about religious extremism. And it's this time outside of London. He wanted to set the film in Bradford, but there was a bit of an uproar. So he filmed it in nearby Halifax. But it is about that city. And it's a bit of an outsider's perspective, I would say. You know, comic, because Qureshi is very good at comedy, and some very interesting things to say about pop music and clothes, but also the desire for purity and a turning away and a renunciation of that amongst young people. Also, you know, about the younger generation being more conservative than their parents. The son in that film is repelled by his father. Close relationship with a prostitute, and the son turns to he gives away his possessions and becomes very involved with a mosque group. Also in fiction, in a novel like Something to Tell You, which is 2008, I don't talk about this in the book, but I have written upon it elsewhere, so I'm a little bit rusty. But in that, there is a British Indian woman who starts wearing the veil after 9/11 because she wants to make a political stance and she wants to see how people will respond to her on the tube. Actually, sorry, it's not after 9/11. It's after 2005, the London bombings. She takes up the veil towards the end of that novel. And there are a few British Pakistani characters who are reflecting a lot more on their religion than in Qureshi's 80s and very early 90s texts. So I think there's been a real shift. He is still fascinated by this whole issue of book burning versus complete freedom of speech, and he's definitely on the freedom of speech side of the argument in sometimes quite dogmatic ways, but he does it with such a lightness of touch and a humour that it's always interesting to read him, I would say.
Maybe somewhere to go from there is with Just Another Jihadi Jane and Home Fire. They talk about similar issues of kind of radicalization, extremism, and but in a different kind of British era, so to speak, in terms of how those types of people are being treated, how radical forms of Islam are being understood within British society. Can you talk a little bit about how you analyze those, which you kind of use or think about kind of the sonic landscape? What does that do in kind of thinking about the contemporary British Muslim context?
Yes, that's great. Well, the sonic landscape, I think they are both very interested in how much we should have empathy for the terrorist and how much we should listen to their arguments, which is obviously a big question that sociologists and anthropologists have been asking for some time. But these writers do it in very lyrical ways through the sense of sound. Both of them just lending such a sharp ear to the current climate, like you say. And in Shamsi's case, she's particularly focused on citizenship and whose voices are heard and who is, you know, has their citizenship as a provisional thing that's easily taken away. She's written an essay for The Guardian a few years ago about being made un-British, about how second generation, third generation, and now fourth British people who have no connection with other countries are, if they do get on the wrong side of the law, even if it's a mistaken identity, they can find themselves stripped of British citizenship in a very racist and Islamophobic way. Kamla Shamsi is so prescient in this novel because she predicts two things that have come to fruition. So she has a Karam Atlone, her character is the first British Muslim Home Secretary, and that happened with Sajid Javid, a very similar kind of character as well, both quite deracinated and uninterested in religion and almost, you know, quite right-wing. And both of them have refused citizenship to a fellow British Muslim, actually. In the novel, it is Parvez, who I mentioned before, this guy who goes to work for a sound man for ISIS. In real life, it was Shamima Begum, so British Bangladeshi, a woman who at 15 was groomed and ended up marrying an ISIS soldier. She is, you know, quite unrepentant. She has been brainwashed, but she does want to come home, and Sajid Javid refused to allow her quite recently. And for the third time, she lost a baby in a refugee camp. So it's been a really big case here in Britain. And Shamsi seems to predict the whole thing. So the novel is so thoughtful and very timely. And it's, of course, a rewriting of Antigone, this idea of the dead body of the terrorist in this case. In Sophocles' play is Polynices, his body is not allowed to be brought back to Thebes. And in Shamsi's Home Fire, it's Parvez's body is not allowed to be brought back to Britain. So the twin sister the Antigone figure is called Anika. She goes to Pakistan to kind of protest her brother's death and lament. And it's very beautifully done. Just another Jihadi Jane. It's interesting that the male writer, Tabish Kerr, is looking at a female jihadist, and Kamala Shamsi, a female novelist, is looking at a male. There's this reversal I've found in other novels as well. Recently, Fatima Bhutto published another ISIS novel called The Runaways, in which she looks at a male, mostly male, jihadist. And then there's a young adult novelist called Muhammad Khan in I Am Thunder. He looks again at a female jihadist. So I'm quite interested in this sort of gender crossing that's going on in some of these ISIS novels, not all of which I have chance to discuss in the book, but I'm hoping to do that in future publishing. And Kerr is interested in, especially in women's voices and how especially a woman in a hijab is not listened to and is spoken for, both in Britain, both by her own community. So women are not allowed to go to graveside because their ululations are thought to distract the mourners from their grieving. So women have to do their grieving at home in these kind of quite diabandi, quite austere communities. And also in mainstream society, in white society, they're not listened to, they're stereotyped in all different ways, as the novelist shows. But then when the girls get, Jamila and her friend get very disillusioned and go to Syria, their voices are not listened to there either, and they have to speak very quietly, not laugh. If they want to watch YouTube, they have to watch silent films and stifle their laughter because they're in such danger. So they're muted in all different ways, and it's a very interesting portrayal of that sound and whether it, you know, it's a sort of rewriting an answer to the question, can the subaltern speak, that's been posed all those years ago. These two novelists seem to be asking, can the oppressor listen, in a way?
And one of the really interesting books and chapter by you is on Hamid's Exit West, which kind of synthesizes the various kind of sensory analysis that you do throughout the book, and kind of think about the future of sensory perception in many ways. So can you kind of just give us like a little recap of what Exit West is all about, and then what happens to the senses in this digital age of advanced technologies? And then how might we, in similar ways to you're talking about Home Fire, how might we think about the current historical and cultural significance of Hamid's work, even though it's this kind of magical realism?
So to recap the novel, it's about two refugees. Well, they become refugees. Their names are Saeed and Nadia, which are well-chosen names because they could be Muslim or Christian names, and they could be from really anywhere from Eastern Europe all the way up to China, more or less. These are quite common names. Saeed, you know, as we know from Edward Saeed, is not necessarily a Muslim name, and Nadia similarly. So these two characters are in an unnamed country, but there are parallels with Pakistan, but maybe also with countries like Syria, because this is a very troubled place with militants doing on the ground executions, and things are really building up. It's a very dangerous place, and Saeed's mother gets shot accidentally. She's just caught in the crossfire. So bad things are happening. And they decide to leave in the end, leave their home country. And the magical realism that you asked about is this device of the doors. So I go into the doors in some detail because it's a way of him talking about technology. So you just open a door and you magically appear. First, Nadia and Saeed appear in Mykonos, and then they go through another door from Greece and end up in London. And Hamid has talked in interviews about this black rectangle of the door being, in a way, a figuration of the phones that we all have in our pockets and we've all got in our hands all the time that take us to another world. So it's a really powerful image of how we're all globally connected now, but also how there's still such structural inequality. So, you know, if there's one bit in the novel where they look at a food fight with some wealthy students, perhaps just flinging food around, and they're so suffering and they're so precarious that this is difficult for them to comprehend. So you can see that this internet age and this connectedness that the phones and WhatsApp and social media has afforded us has not done away with inequality. So the migrants are highly dependent on their phones. It's like the sixth sense that they need in order to cross borders. You know, information is shared online. And the first thing that Nadia and Saeed do wherever they end up is to start looking for signal so that they can connect with people and get information that they need to stay safe. And this is true of migrants in real life as well. I looked at a few academic papers about phones and what a necessity they are to contemporary refugees. Most of the advice is on WhatsApp groups and things. And in fact, recently there was an Iranian Kurdish writer who texted his memoir from an Australian refugee camp to his translator. So he published the bulk of this novel, which has mountains in the title. I can't quite remember the name. He texts it to his translator. It's a tool of resistance. It can be, but it's also a tool of surveillance. So the authorities are keeping tabs on these migrants, and drones are also following them around, like I was saying before. So these tools of resistance can be turned against them. So it's a very interesting balancing act that Mohsin Hamid does in this novel. And one of his characters, Saeed, is more sceptical, and he turns his phone off for most of the day and just allows himself 1 hour of browsing at night time because he thinks it's a distraction, and he has worries about this world. He's also the more religious of the two characters. I don't know if that's exactly connected, but that's how it is. Nadia, as a woman, she's very restricted in her movements, so she just finds the freedom that the internet and her phone affords her is irresistible, and she doesn't constrain herself at all. She's constantly wandering the earth through her phone in the way that she cannot do in real life.
Well, Claire, it's really a wonderful book, and I'm glad I was able to talk to you. Thank you for making the time. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on now? You're always doing awesome stuff.
Okay, that's great. It's been lovely to talk to you and really interesting, and I hope I wasn't too tired and I answered properly. I hope I probably misspoke a few times. But anyway, my next publication is in press, so I'm very excited about this anthology of British Muslim women's writing that I'm bringing out in probably around June next year. It's called A Match Made in Heaven. So it's my first foray into editing fiction. So I've got 14 wonderful writers, some of them really famous, like Shalina Zahrajan Mohammed, who's the author of Love in a Headscarf. She did a story for me. And Aisha Malik, who's done Sophia Khan Is Not Obliged. She's another author. Beena Shah from Pakistan, who has spent a lot of time in Britain. She's another of the published authors. And then half of them are not very well known. They came out of creative writing workshops I've been organising in Glasgow, Yorkshire, and Newcastle. So we found lots of upcoming writers who are really exciting. Some of them are so bold and talented, and that you'll be seeing a lot more of them in the future. So the theme was love and desire. So again, like the senses, I'm interested in kind of happy topics or interesting topics. I mean, some of these stories are very dark, so not automatically happy, but we were interested in the everyday experiences of love and desire, you know, not so much the sensational stories. So the writers interpreted the brief in many different ways, and the book, I'm really proud of it. It's such a good read, you know, all these different stories to dip into. And then relatedly, I'm involved in a co-authored book about working with sociologists and geographers, as well as other cultural activists and literary specialists. So we're about five of us doing a very similar book to A Match Made in Heaven, but in an academic style. So we're drawing on interviews with young people age 18 to 30 from British Pakistani backgrounds. We're talking to them about their love lives or their dreams for the future, their frustrations, the stereotyping around their love and desire, all different themes, and then bringing in the literature to look for parallels. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
That's great. Congrats. That sounds like really awesome stuff.
Thank you.
Well, Claire, thanks again for making the time, and good luck on your future endeavors.
Thank you. And you too.
That was my conversation with Claire Chambers about making sense of contemporary British Muslim novels, published with Palgrave in 2019. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.